So we're very fortunate to have Deva Mitra here today. So Deva Mitra lives in a community in Birmingham, and he's a very experienced order member with lots of interesting stories. He's just come to speak to us today and share a few of those. Now, I won't do very much in the way of an introduction. I'll let him speak a bit about his own life. But I will say that he's done several notable things. He was the founder of the Norwich Buddhist Centre. So he set that up and was then president for quite a while. Is that correct? Yes. He was also, I should also say that he's been ordained for 39 years, and he was ordained at 25. Yeah. And for much of his, or for at least half of his time he's been ordained, he's been worldwide Mitra convener. So he was responsible for the Mitra system throughout the whole world. So that's quite a significant role.
Throughout the universe.
Could get his perspective.
And he did that for over 20 years. And now he does bits and pieces, including teaching in India and other things. But anyway, it's a pleasure to have you here, Deva Mitra.
It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Right. So a very good way of talking to order members, I find, is to firstly ask them what their name means.
Oh, Deva Mitra.
Yeah.
It depends which particular interpretation you want to put on it. When I was ordained, Bhante said you could either regard it as meaning divine friend, or friend of the gods, or godlike friend, something of that sort. Hmm. But he gave me the name partly because it was the ordained name taken by Anagarika Dharmapala when at the very end of his life he became a bhikkhu. And so he very pointedly said to me, and you know Dharmapala set up over 100 Buddhist centres worldwide. So that was a bit of a hint. I don't know, but he managed to set up one. So that's the significance of my name.
Great. And could you tell us a little bit about how you came to Buddhism originally? Obviously you came quite young, or you met Sangharakshita fairly young.
Well, my first contact with Buddhism was in Nepal in 1971, when I was having a short break from my career. I was in the mountains, and I was suffering from pneumonia at a very high altitude, and was looked after by a Buddhist monk who didn't speak a word of English, but he was so kind. And he didn't have to do anything for me at all, but he looked after both myself and my trekking companion for several days while we recovered. And that had a very, very deep impression upon me, not just the fact that he was so kind. He seemed to have a quality which I knew I did not have. He seemed to have a certain kind of peace, for want of a better expression. It was as if he was at peace with himself in a way that I knew that I was not. And so a year later, when I was having a sort of existential crisis, I remembered that, and I decided I wanted to learn to meditate, and specifically I wanted to find myself a Buddhist teacher. That was in London in 1972, exactly 40 years ago. So I'd read about, well, the FWBO, as it was called then. There was a book called Alternative London, and it listed all the Buddhist organisations and groups, which was the Buddhist Society and the FWBO. And that's all there was then. The FWBO, or Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, according to Alternative London, at that time, didn't have any premises. So it took me a while to find the FWBF Centre, but when I eventually did, I knew immediately that this was the place for me.
And what was it about that initial experience that grabbed you?
It's very difficult to say. I mean, it was, we used to have a centre in North London, in Archway in fact, which was an old piano factory, converted piano factory, and I don't know, just the atmosphere in the room was, it was quite unique. There was a certain kind of excitement in the air for me, but at the same time a certain kind of peace, that the quality that I felt in this monk back in Nepal, and the two came together, and I don't know, it just felt like I was coming home. I mean, many, many people have had this experience and will use that overworked metaphor, but it really was my experience. I knew I'd come for life, and that was 40 years ago, so it was probably true. I'm still here.
I mean, it's very interesting because we just had a little group exercise where we talked about what the LBC means for people. And some of the things that came out of that were things like the connection with people and the feeling of energy and so forth. So it's interesting that that's the same experience that you've had. So I'm just curious as to how things sort of developed after that. I mean, what sort of age did you come along at, and how quickly did you get ordained after that?
Okay, I was 24 when I came along, and I was ordained 18 months later. I was 25. So it was all very rapid, but I remember when I asked for ordination, I'd been coming along for about a year, and I asked Bhante, you know, will you please ordain me, and he seemed to hear what I'd said, and then after 2 or 3 months nothing had happened. So I reminded him, I said, look, you do realise I do want to be ordained, and he said, I did hear you the first time, or something like that. But it seemed to be taking an inordinate length of time. I couldn't understand why I was not getting ordained. So eventually he gave way to pressure, and after 6 months of asking, I was ordained. We did things differently in those days.
So what's your, dare we ask, what are your opinions on the current sort of process that can take 5 or 7 or 10 years?
I don't think I'd have seen it through. I don't know. I mean, I'm a very impatient kind of fellow. And, I don't know. Maybe I would, but I don't know. I really think I might not. And I think there probably are a lot of people who find the present setup a little bit off-putting or daunting. And we are aware of that. And I know that the ordination teams are sort of looking into ways of trying to circumvent that, especially for the problems that the present setup raises for younger people, because, you know, I can remember what it was like to be young, even though it was a long time ago, and you know, you want things to happen more quickly than they tend to do, and I think there's I think young people have to learn to be patient, but on the other hand, I think older people need to see that it's not just always impatience. It wasn't just impatience with me. I really wanted to commit my life to something. I thought I'd committed my life to something which didn't work out. I used to be an actor, and I worked in the theatre, and I loved the theatre, it was my life, but I became disillusioned with it. And in a way, the theatre was not big enough to contain my idealism. But I wanted something that was big enough to do that, and the darkness seemed just about big enough to contain even me. But I think when you're young, you have that kind of energy, that kind of desire, that kind of hunger, and I think it needs to be fed properly, rather than just sort of making people wait forever and ever and ever, it seems.
And can I... in fact, I might just draw that out a little bit. So you were an actor, and you were presumably quite ambitious in being an actor. And then you found this thing that was somehow bigger than that. I mean, I think a lot of us have careers or things we've worked towards and have been foremost in our lives, and then suddenly we find them overtaken by wanting to practice the Dharma. Could you say a little bit about that sort of transition for you?
I think with me, I reached a point in life, I mentioned I had an existential crisis, and part of that crisis for me was being thoroughly disillusioned with my career. I still believed in the theatre, but I suppose the reality of the theatre just did not match my own idealism. I mean, I was over-idealistic, no question. I mean, the fault is hugely mine, but on the other hand, I brought a certain idealism to my work which I didn't see reflected in many other of my colleagues, actors or directors. And so by the time I came across the movement, I was already on the way out, in a sense. I was looking for an alternative to that, even though it had meant so much to me all my life. And so the transition for me was relatively smooth and easy. I just I just gave myself fully to the movement.
So am I right in thinking that this sort of disillusionment arose out of you putting lots of effort into your acting career and it not fulfilling you or not satisfying you?
It's not quite like that. I mean, I was working with people who, it seems to me, didn't take their work sufficiently seriously. And I suppose the biggest bugbear that I experienced in the theatre was that most actors seemed to be content to just entertain. And I wasn't into entertainment. I wasn't doing it because I wanted to entertain. I was doing it because I wanted to communicate something of a higher value in some way. And that most actors just didn't seem to be interested in that. Some were, for sure, and there are some really good people who work in that world, but most of them did not come up to my exacting standards. Perhaps I didn't come up to those either.
So, could we talk a little bit about some of the things you've done while you've
been
an order member? So, perhaps the setting up of the Norwich Centre.
Mm-hmm.
Just be interested in your experiences in sort of setting up that project. Sort of, how did you come across it? Was it difficult? Any sort of things that major challenges that you came across during that project?
Okay. Well, I was ordained 18 months after I first came along, and at the time that I was ordained, Bante was emphasising the fact that he expected, he's just speaking those terms in those days, all order members to do at least 1 month's solitary retreat every year. And I dutifully did my first solitary retreat, and I suppose I had this idea in my mind of, you know, being a second Milarepa. It didn't work out. I found meditation very, very difficult, especially in solitude for 5 weeks. And in fact, it nearly drove me up the wall. So I realised that, you know, I was not a natural born meditator, that I had other work that I needed to do. And I still had a very, very strong feeling for the Dharma, and the Dharma was definitely going to be my life, but there's no way that I was going to end up spending most of my time meditating. So I thought, well, what can I do? And I read something on that retreat, I can't remember in what context, something about a bodhisattva who had decided that he would practice Dharma for the whole of his life. I thought, ah, I can do that. So the idea of practicing Dharma and giving the Dharma came together, and the obvious thing therefore to do was to go somewhere and set up a centre. So that's what I did. But it all sort of gradually came clear to me during the course of those 5 weeks on that first solitary retreat. And it was a very, very positive experience for me. There were difficulties insofar as I was not used to taking responsibility in a certain sort of way. Now suddenly I was becoming responsible for property and so on and so forth. But and in a certain sense also for other people, although in a sense you also cannot be responsible for anybody else. But in a certain sense I was. And I think that all had a very, very maturing effect upon me. And a very stimulating effect too. I really enjoyed teaching and meeting people and getting to know them.
So how do you sort of go about setting up something of that size and scale? I mean, is it just, you know, there was a bit of a pioneering spirit back in those days, so did you just go out and do it, or did you...?
I just went out and did it. I hadn't a clue what I was going to do, how to go about it. In fact, we had very few centres at that time. It was just the one in Archway, and we were beginning to... I think we might possibly have acquired this property at that time, but it was a wreck. It was a wrecked fire station. And there's a centre in Brighton. I don't know that we had any other centres. So there was not much experience that I could draw from. Buddhadas had been down to Brighton to set up a centre then. I probably talked with him, I can't remember. I just moved to Norwich and found somewhere to live with an academic who... Actually, his wife had just walked out on him, so he had a spare room in his house and was quite keen to have a lodger, a bit of company. So I moved in with him. He eventually became an order member, by the way. And he very kindly supported me. He gave me £5 a week pocket money that lived rent free. And I eventually found a property and had some savings from my beer advert, so I was able to set the centre up. But how did I go about it? I don't know, it was just something I felt I wanted to do, or that I needed to do. Partly that I needed to do it because of my experience on the solitary retreat, but also because I really positively wanted to do something for the Dharma. When I first met Sangha Rakshita, he'd actually suggested to me, well, instead of giving up your career, don't give it up, set up a Buddhist theatre company. And I did think about that, but it didn't really appeal to me. I wanted to do something more direct, that I consider to be more directly dharmic. But I know that nowadays, it's a question for quite a lot of people coming along who want to get more involved in what we're doing, and perhaps would like to engage in a project like that. So how do you go about it? And I would say, you've got to find out what it is you want to do. I mean, there's still plenty of scope for initiative, I would have thought. I mean, for a start, we do not have a Buddhist theatre company. Why not? We do have a theatre, which even Sir Peter Hall knows that we have, and wonders what those Buddhists are doing with it. Why aren't they, you know, putting on a new theatre there? So we have this theatre in Cambridge. We don't have a Buddhist theatre company, so that could be an option for somebody with the right kind of background and experience and training.
So people talk about the early days of the movement being a bit more pioneering. I've heard phrase being used. I mean, is that your sense? I mean, was there a quality or a different energy around than there is now?
Well, I think that there was a different kind. We emerged from a different popular culture, which, you know, the idea of changing the world into a better place was very much part of the culture that I emerged with. It was in the popular music in a way that I think was subsequently lost, and it affected my generation in a very particular way. I mean, I am of the hippie generation, although I was not a hippie myself, I hasten to add. But although most of my friends and fellow order members at that time probably were. But there was something in the atmosphere of the culture at that time which I think is no longer present, although there are signs that perhaps it's beginning to re-emerge a little bit in one or two places. But that was on our side. Whether or not we were pioneering, I never really thought about that. I suppose we were, because we were trying to start bring into existence something which, up until that point, did not exist. And now, as far as you're concerned, much of it is there. But that's not the end of the story, by any means. I mean, there's plenty of scope for pioneering, if we have any pioneers out there.
So, I mean, it's interesting that you sort of talked about the view that, you know, people are turning up at the centre that's sort of already there, all sort of set out, and you can sort of just come along and so forth. I mean, what do you think about this perception of people seeing the centre as a sort of fixed structure or, you know, like an unchanging institution or something like that?
Do people actually perceive it in that kind of way?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's certainly a sense that I've got from a few people.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily universal.
Of course, there's always a danger with any institution that things reach a point of inertia and things actually do get settled and fixed. I hope that that isn't happening here or at any of our other centres, but in principle, things need to be constantly shifting and changing according to changing needs, because the society that we live in is constantly changing, and we need to constantly shift our approach and respond accordingly and appropriately to those needs. I'm not sure if that really answers your question there.
Let me go on a little bit then.
Yeah.
I mean, given the sort of necessity of having these structures, so, you know, we're a charity that requires a certain amount of structure.
Yeah.
You know, is there a place for individuals within that structure, you know, where we have a fixed hierarchy, the perception of a fixed hierarchy, like, you know, the council and chairman and so forth.
Yeah.
Can individuals make a difference?
I suppose Well, that might imply that the members of the hierarchy are not individuals, if you're going to use that kind of terminology. I know most of the people who run the centre here, they're my friends, and I certainly don't consider them to be non-individuals. But how do you relate to a structure, or an institution, as an individual coming in from the outside? Is that the question?
I think that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Because I suppose I didn't really have that experience, because there wasn't much structure or institution when I came around, and the first person I got to know in the movement was Sangharakshana anyway, so I came in at the top, as it were. I haven't had the kind of experience that some of you might have had, and which some of you might have been finding frustrating. But all I can say is, certainly we do need the structures that we've got in order for a place like this to function, in order for people like yourselves to come along and benefit. But once you've come along, and perhaps you've benefited to a certain degree, and you want to contribute, and have your own influence and impact within that institution, that then becomes an issue for you, presumably. And, you know, it's up to you to find your... that's your problem. And, you know, it's like you've got to find the answer to that. It's like I have to find my own answer with regards to, well, why wasn't I the second Buddha? You know, why was it that every time I sat down to meditate, I just got bored? I got bored of my own company for 5 weeks with nobody else other than sheep in wet Wales in dark December. So, you know, it's like life presents you problems, and I would hope that there is sufficient willingness and openness and desire on the part of the order members who, by and large, run the centre, who will be able to respond and stimulate you in a way that, you know, you can deepen your own involvement to the extent, to the fullest extent that you wish. But very often what happens is, and I used to experience this in Norwich, is that you'd set something up, I set the centre up in Norwich, and people would have all sorts of ideas about what you should be doing, what I should be doing. Because you know, I was running the centre, I was the chairman of the council anyway, and I was actually taking most of the classes. So questions would come along, would be put to me like, well, why don't you do this, and why don't you do that? And, I mean, there's a limit to what any one person can do, but, you know, I suppose my question to them should have been, not that I thought of it at the time, well, why don't you do it? You know, if this is such a good idea, why can't you do that? So if you have bright ideas, test them out on the order members, see if you can, you know, take them somewhere. I mean, there's plenty of scope for anyone with imagination to help extend knowledge of the Dharma in this city. I mean, for example, I mean, this is a bit of an extreme example, and I wouldn't know where to begin myself, but... There's a large Muslim community around here. Very, very few Muslims or ex-Muslims come along to our centre. It might be possible to find a way, a group of people with the right kind of sensitivities and knowledge and experience to sort of make inroads into that community. I think it'd be very difficult, mind you, but you never know. If you want a challenge, why not take up something like that? Try and see if you can get to know a few people with that kind of background and draw them into what interests you. Or, you know, just think in terms of targeting a group that you have a connection with. I mean, like, I tried when I was younger, and I failed miserably, but I did try to draw some of my theatre friends into the Dharma. But they were so caught up with their work and career, they weren't really that interested. But you never know, you might be able to find a group of people that you can draw in like that. Because you have a particular background or a particular interest, you have a particular connection with a particular group of people, you might be able to draw them in. I mean, I'm just sort of throwing these ideas out. I mean, there are all sorts of things you could do. But in the end, you have to find what it is that you want to do. I mean, that's true for all of us, like it was true for me on that retreat. I had to find out what I really wanted to do. unfortunately, I did.
Okay, great, thank you. And so, we've got this order that's, grown up out of these personal relationships in the early days.
Yeah.
And it's grown into this slightly more sort of, structured entity.
Yeah.
What sort of thing do you think that the order can offer sort of younger people who are interested in Buddhism or interested in thinking of getting more involved? Do you think it's the same sort of things as you were drawn to back then?
Well, I don't see in principle why not. I mean, but again, it depends entirely upon the individual. It depends on each one of you, what you want from your life. I knew what I wanted from my life. I wanted something to commit myself to, something to give a greater meaning to my life than the one I already had, or to give some meaning even to my life. And I saw the work of practicing and introducing the Dharma into the West, but not just into the West, I mean anywhere in the world, frankly, where the Dharma is unknown, was something I could engage with and that would stimulate me and help others. And there's still scope for anyone who wants to do that. Just seems to take a little bit longer, unfortunately, these days, but I don't see why it should not, I think that the same opportunities are there, you've just got to look for them and find them and seize them. Is that what you asked me?
Yeah.
Sometimes lose track of where I'm going.
I'll stop you if you wander too far. That's fine.
All right, good.
So some of the times I've heard people who are interested in Buddhism talk about one of the fears that some people have heard say is the fear of sort of losing your identity as you as you're practicing.
Yeah.
So I think it gets wrapped up with this thing of sort of overcoming the ego. So
right.
You know, this idea that you overcome the ego and you suddenly lose your identity, or you stop becoming yourself, you somehow become a Buddhist robot or something like that.
Right.
I just wondered if you had any views on whether you think Buddhism sort of reduces, or you lose your identity in Buddhism.
Certainly not in my experience. I think I have, throughout 40 years of practice, had glimpses of what it might be like to sort of, have the ego suspended just for a short period of time, maybe a few moments at a time, and it's like a glimpse of freedom. It's certainly not that you're suddenly becoming something robotic or mechanical, or that things fall apart. The question you've asked me sort of relates to the idea of, it's a bit like being a clone, isn't it? You the idea of becoming the same as everybody else. That's connected with this sort of idea of, in a way, becoming a sub-individual rather than a true individual. I think if that worries anybody, what you have to do in this context is look around you and look at the order members that you know, especially those who are long in the tooth like myself, and just ask yourselves, aren't they the Mitra and Munitashri clones? They're so like each other, or whoever else you have, or Majra Bandhu, or Jnana Vacha. Just ask yourself, what about the people I know? Do they strike me as being Buddhist clones? Are they all basically the same, lacking individuality? Just, they just wear different clothes, really. They're all, that's the only difference that you'll see. It's up to you to try and see us, or not, as the case may be.
Okay, great. So, You know, I sort of asked you to come today because you strike me as a very clear example of an individual, true individual.
Well, that's very flattering.
And, but your, some of your views or opinions aren't always necessarily to everyone's, what should we say, in line with everyone's own opinions. Yeah. And there's been a few sort of controversies and things that you've been happy to highlight or happy to address. I wondered if you could tell us about one of them or a couple of them.
Well, I suppose the well, first of all, you may or may not be aware, I do have a reputation for controversy. I think unfairly I have a reputation for seeking controversy for its own sake, and actually I don't. I would maintain that I don't. But some years ago we had a big problem with one of our centres in Croydon. This is part of FWBO history. And when things went badly wrong there. And
Could you say a little bit about what went wrong?
What went wrong? I think in the end what went wrong was, well, basically you had one order member who was very charismatic and many, very, very gifted man in many ways, but I think things went to his head a little bit, that he was like, it was as if he became the head of a group, we had a number of communities attached to the centre, and he lived in one of them, and things seemed to be wrong pretty much on along a kind of authoritarian line, rather than, you know, on the principle of cooperation, which is how we try to function. And there was some unfortunate incidents, to put it mildly. I mean, people treated very badly. I mean, not in a very extreme way, but very, very unkindly. But this centre they seemed to have a particular interpretation of Bante's teaching of the Dharma, and it's one which seemed to be out of kilter with the spirit of what we're trying to do. Now, at that time, I was the overall mitra convener, so I had responsibility for the mitra system throughout the entire movement, including the Croydon Centre. So that meant I had to go there, and I did very regularly. And I could see that something wasn't right. It wasn't just me. We all knew there was something wrong, but we didn't quite know how to address the problems that we were faced with. But my general approach in life has always been pretty much a head-on one. If there's a problem, you just deal with it. The sort of confrontational method, I suppose. I'm not a diplomat, never have been. Diplomacy is something I need to learn. But a number of my friends were very concerned with the way that I was going about dealing with the Croydon situation. In fact, one of my friends accused me of gumboat diplomacy, which is no diplomacy at all. Nonetheless, I would always, if there was an issue, if something unfortunate happened, I would always raise it and try and address it, try and argue it through. I suppose I would, what's that expression from Ian Foster? Pope, Alexander Pope. Where angels fear to tread, I would go. And I helped to resolve the situation by, I suppose, that kind of approach. In the end, my friends acknowledged that, you know, nothing else would have helped to resolve the situation. But that's the sort of thing that I do, or have done. I have blundered in other areas, without going into those, but does that give you a taste?
Mm, absolutely. That's very good. Maybe I could ask you questions all night, but perhaps we should open it up to other people to see if they have any questions for you.
That's fine.
Yeah. Would anybody have a particular question they would like to ask David Mitra? Go on, Hannah.
I just wonder if you feel like you left acting behind, or whether you were able to.
I definitely left it behind. I'm often asked, don't I miss it? And in a sense I do, because I knew from the age of four I was bound for stage. And, you know, it's something which is deeply embedded in my genes or whatever. And I can't really bring it I couldn't really bring it into our movement unless we had our own theatre group. And I did seriously consider doing that when I stopped being Metro-Cumbian. I actually came down to London and tried to get together those few professionals that we had to see if we could do something together, but it didn't work out. One of the regrets that I have in my life, it's only a small regret and it doesn't trouble me badly, but it is a minor regret that I no longer have the opportunity to play Shakespeare, which I love doing. I also understand and accept that I could not have done what I've done with my life had I maintained my career. And the theatre is a very jealous mistress. You know, you either do it or you don't, I'm afraid. There doesn't seem to be a halfway house. Yeah?
Yeah, and following from that, do you think you're happier now in life because you followed Buddha's path?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was very, very unhappy when I stopped working. For a number of reasons, not just to do with my disillusionment with the actual reality of the theatre, but I think I've led, by and large, a very happy life. That doesn't mean to say it's all been happy. I've had my downers like everybody else, and they'll still happen. Because that's the way... That's what life is like, you know, it's unsatisfactory. Even the Dharma life, you know, will bring to the surface painful experiences. And they might even be more painful than the ones you've had before you're practicing the Dharma. I think I could probably say that too, because there's a greater degree of awareness. Your awareness of the pain is more intense too. At least that's been my experience. But notwithstanding that, I think it's certainly the case that I'm sure, in fact, that my life has been much happier than it would have been had I stuck with what I was doing. I think I'd have gone mad, actually. Yeah. An extreme character. Yes?
So do you feel that being an actor and being a Buddhist can't go hand in hand? Or is that how it was for you personally?
No, I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't say that they can't go hand in hand. When I said that the theatre's a jealous, very jealous mistress, I mean, things have changed in that world now, but from when I was working in it. But it's very difficult to pursue, it'd be very difficult to pursue a full-time career as an actor and also practice the Dharma to any depth, I suspect. Because it'd be very difficult to get away on retreat. Well, there are other considerations too. One of the things that troubled me about my work was that, well, the last job I did involved playing a thoroughly evil character, and I don't suppose it's changed very much from what I hear. But what you were expected to do was, you know, you become that character, and for 2 hours every night, I was being the embodiment of evil. I was playing the principal role in this play, and it was a thoroughly evil part. And I got into very, very black mental states when I was playing it. In the mornings, I was doing the Metta-Bhavana practice. An actress friend of mine, many years later, said to me that she was seriously concerned about, you know, the sort of mental strains I was under doing that at that time. Fortunately, I could see that this, I couldn't continue with this. And so I decided to quit. Now that's an extreme example. You don't often get asked to play such black parts as that. And in a certain sense, I was very, very unlucky. But, you know, to some extent, all actors have to do that sort of thing. And I think, therefore, I do have some reservations about acting as a means of livelihood for a Buddhist. But maybe there is a middle way that we need to find, you know, that I'm sure, actually I'm sure there is. Within a Buddhist context, we haven't actually done it yet. We haven't found what that is. I quit for a number of reasons. Not just that. I would hope it is possible. Yeah.
This is sort of question block. I'm interested about your ordination. So you got ordained very quickly.
Yeah.
And it's sort of I wonder about the effect of ordination, what it's for, how it sort of pertains to identity, identifying with a group or community.
Sure.
of Buddhists. There was something to do with your point as well, about this sort of the middle way. I mean, I suppose I feel, I've been coming here for 2 years, and
yes.
My practice in the last kind of 6 to 12 months has really ramped up, and I'm really getting into it. But there's something in me that feels like, I don't ever want to become a mitra or an order member,
mm-hmm.
but I want to be really close here, because I kind of want to find a middle way. And we were discussing earlier about how it's difficult, you know, when you start practicing, you find it really difficult to relate to the peer groups you related to before, and that you sort of naturally want to withdraw.
Mm.
And I sort of want to, because I find it hard to communicate with the people around me now. I'm basically just talking now rather than asking questions, but how do you reflect? Do you have any reflections on that and how your path has panned out in terms of ordination? What would happen if you had never been ordained but still been involved closely with Buddhism?
I think that the big difference for me with regards to ordination was that by becoming ordained, I actually entered a spiritual community, and that meant that I was part of a community of people who were committed to the same ideas and gave me a certain kind of support. Which I wouldn't otherwise have had. So they, if you like, support me to be myself at my best. It's very difficult to kind of explain that, but by and large it's been my experience, not always, because the way that Banzai described our order is as an aspiring spiritual community. Like, things went badly wrong in Croydon. Just to use one example, and not all order members will behave like individuals all the time. I also will lapse from time to time into sub-individual mode, especially if I lose my temper or whatever, I've blown it. But all I can say is I have found that being a member of a spiritual community very, very supportive and very, very helpful. I find it difficult to see that I would have been able to change so positively as I believe I have done without that support. Theoretically, I could have done it on my own, but I think it's very difficult to do it on your own, because you can't really see yourself very, very clearly. And the big advantage of spiritual friends is that they can be a bit more objective about you than you can yourself. And you might not like what they're telling you, and you might push it away and keep on pushing it away, but sooner or later you have to, they help you to face the reality. You know, you are, undiplomatic in my case, or whatever it happens to be, and deal with it. I can understand why you would have the kind of fears that you have about becoming an order member, mitra, and so on and so forth, because it's all to do with being feeling that you're being part of a group, and when you become part of a group, you lose your individual identity. But that has not been my experience as a member of our order. And that's all I can say. I mean, but there's something else that was bothering you. What was it?
Well, I just decided to sort of pick up on what you said there. I mean, I think it feels, and you know, obviously you can never be completely sure about your motives, but it feels to me like my reticence to become a mitra or an order member would somehow be to not get to not dive into the spiritual. Because I suppose my impression coming here is that, you know, it's a wonderful, wonderful place and wonderfully supportive, and it's a wonderful community, and I feel very at home here. And it's really changed my life. But it seems to me somewhat gated.
Somewhat
gated. There are sort of gates to it, but right. And I'd kind of like, I feel myself wanting to sit on the fence. Not, it doesn't feel like it's fears. It feels like more because I sort of want to go. I feel like I want to go further out into the world.
Oh right.
Yeah. And so be a sort of half Buddhist and not have a case of it.
Okay. Okay.
Not because I want.
But you can be. That's fine.
Yeah.
There's no problem about that. Is that?
No, I don't know.
But I don't see the problem. I mean, if that's what you want, you can sit on the fence for as long as you like and sort of be a half Buddhist and do what you want to do in the wider world. No one's stopping you. And you can still come along for as long as you like. And you can never get ordained or become a mitra, and that's fine.
But then can you fully benefit from the Dharma teaching if you're just like half Buddhist?
Well, I would say that you probably would not get, would not be able to go into things to such depth or benefit so much. But you know, that's something you have to work out for yourself.
Well, I suppose,
or anybody else.
I suppose, sort of thinking about other people, because I mean, I feel that it's so powerful that it's something I'd want to share with. But for example, with my friends, I'm a musician. And so my friends in the music industry, again, you know, I imagine it's like acting, it's quite hard. And I think if I really went into this and got really withdrawn, then I could see myself becoming less relevant to them. I want to sort of stay relevant to them. Do you see what I mean? So it's not necessarily about just my own good. It's about
I understand. I think I understand anyway, because I was in the same dilemma with my own friends. I wanted to bring them all in because I found this wonderful thing, and they weren't interested. Not remotely, not one of them. And I found that deeply frustrating, and in the end, I just had to let go of them. Not completely, I mean, I still see one or two people occasionally from my past, but not very often. And we have actually very, very little in common, and I find that deeply saddening, but it's just the fact, the reality, they're not interested in leading a spiritual life, and I can't make them. Yes, Lydia, sorry, you wanted to get in before.
I can practice
Kshatriya. Okay, good. Then you can teach me.
What you said about your acting career touched me quite deeply, actually, on two levels. Firstly, in your suggestion that you felt it was too difficult to have that kind of career that demanded that much time and be able to practice the Dharma as fully. So there's like a time issue around it,
that's right,
your energy into your life. I forgot what session exactly was now. I'll come back to it. And secondly, with the whole playing the evil character, so how this was difficult for you because it brought up some sort of ethical dilemma in terms of your metta bhavana practice and where you wanted to be, and then the mental state that you were having to go into in order to.
I think it brought me close to psychosis.
Yeah. So
a bit more serious than an ethical issue.
Okay. I found this really interesting because I feel in a sense, well, I work in finance.
Yeah.
And I feel in a sense like I play a role.
Right.
That is perhaps not as, well, definitely not as ethical as I would like.
Right.
And also, it demands so much of my time and my energy, and it's a very big issue in my life right now that I've asked for ordination, decided that I want to give my life, and yet feeling trapped, it
in an environment that I know it's not this way for everybody. I know that, and I know that I hold many wrong views. But certainly this feeling that to be here in London requires so much money to actually survive, that I have yet to find a way to make that work, like how to find more time to practice and still pay the extortionate rent here. Yeah. And it's, I feel a real sort of tension. Would you have anything to say on that?
you've got a problem. I mean, I don't mean a psychological problem. I mean an actual, practical one. I mean, how do you do that? I don't know. I mean, it wasn't so extreme when I was living in London when I was younger. Rents weren't that extortionate and you could somehow get by. But clearly, it's beyond my imagination just how difficult it is for you now. Things have changed so much. But I think that if the kind of work that you're doing is causing you some kind of ethical tensions, then somehow or other you're going to have to address them. Either you will have to change your work or find a way of dealing with those tensions. For me, I couldn't find a way of dealing with the tensions that the kind of work that I was doing raised. I had to get out. But I mean, there were other factors which were forcing me out anyway, which I will describe to you. It's very difficult, and I think that this is, in a way, one of the problems with leading a Dharma life. It's very challenging, and it makes hard challenges. For example, what security do you have leading a Dharma life? You know, where's your pension scheme? I ain't got one. I'm 64. When I'm 64. That was an issue which troubled me in my mid-50s. Who's going to look after me? I'm old. You know, I'd lost my job. My mental system was going to change. I was no longer overall mental convener. What am I going to do? How am I going to support myself? 54. And it kept me awake at night. Occasionally, not every night. And so I had to work with that. That's what life at that point, that was the challenge that my life was bringing to me there. It just resolved. I could have allowed myself to get carried away by that fear of who's going to look after me when I'm old, done the sort of thing that a lot of men in their 50s do, go and get married. Actually, don't want to get married, but quite content living in a community. But I think at every stage of your life, you're going to be presented with some pretty tough challenges, and that is because of the nature of the Dharma. It's very difficult for us to let it really sink in. Life is fundamentally, unremittingly unsatisfactory, and you'll be faced with these kind of problems whatever you do. I'm still faced by them. You know, they just take on a new. It's like they put on a new overcoat each time. But I think that. Notwithstanding that, it's a hackneyed image, but the layers of the onion just keep peeling one layer off, just come across another layer, you've got to take that layer off, another layer. But eventually, hopefully, you get to the heart of the onion. Nothingness. There's a film which was very popular in the 70s, and Sangharakshan mentions it in one of his lectures, called Terem by Pasolini. And in his lecture, some of you may have heard it, he comments how this young man in the film, young Englishman, comes into contact with all these various characters, and I think he manages to have sex with every one of them, including the old lady. But that's really sort of, it's more like an image for something. The fact is that he changes their lives radically. Everybody's life is changed as a result of coming into contact with him. And You know, it's a bit like that when you come into contact with the spiritual community, or you could say with the Dharma. You know, it's like it changes your perspective on things. The people that you come into contact with change your experience, they change your way of seeing things. Things are never going to be quite the same again. But it doesn't mean that your life from that point is going to be problem free. It just means you're going to have to face them in different sort of ways. Life is problematic. You know, per se, you can't get away from that. It's problematic because it is fundamentally unsatisfactory, and we keep trying to gain satisfaction from this source, from that source, from another source, and it never works. Hopefully, finally, eventually, the penny will drop. That is the nature of reality. That's why you're here, by the way.
Perhaps we should have done that. That was fantastic. Thank you so much for coming and speaking to us.
It's been a delight. It's been sobering, though, thinking that you're all at least half my age.
Well,
sorry, go on.
I'll leave you with that thought. Well, I think we should thank you for coming.
I'm always willing to come back.
Oh, well, you'd be very welcome.
Good.
So I just wanted to sort of wrap up and try and pull out that theme, this theme of individuality a little bit, just to close. And hopefully we've heard a little bit about how individuals are really important, how this movement was built from individuals, basically, taking on projects and doing things. And that, you know, all of these projects that the centre does or the movement does has somebody with vision at the head of it, somebody who believes in what they're doing and why they're doing it. So I just sort of wanted to encourage you to go away and think about that, sort of what is it that really grabs you? What is it that really interests you? Is there something that you'd be willing to stand up and do something about? You know, whether it's Buddhist, whether it's whatever, whatever. What is it that really, really grabs you? I think Dev Mitchell touched on it really, really nicely. Actually, is that we sometimes get emails from people saying, "Oh, wouldn't it be good if we were doing this? Wouldn't it be good if the centre was doing more outreach or more this or that?" And of course, it would be. Yeah, absolutely. But the thing is that the Sub-35s is run by a small team, and that this project is our project. We put our heart and soul into this, and this is what we believe in. So there just isn't really any more room for us to take on more things. So, you know, if you do have something you're interested in doing, just let us know. One thing we can do is put you in touch with people who can help you, you know, or put you in touch with all the members, or put you in touch with, this structure that's the LBC. So, you know, don't ever be afraid to just email us about anything you want to do. And one of the things another one of the projects I'm interested in doing is collecting together people who are interested. So I'm going to start a database of people who have skills or want to get more involved. And I'll put that on our mailing list email for you to join up. And, you know, that will be projects that people like you guys are running, or some of the Sub-35 projects, or often get asked to find people for retreat teams and classes and things like that. So if you're interested, just put your name down on that. Okay, so it's 1:45, so let's wrap up for the night. But thank you all so much for coming. I hope it's been enjoyable. It's been a real pleasure to have Dev Mitra here, so just thank you once again for coming.